You're listening to Vatican Radio. What is the relationship between religion and violence? How can faith be part of the solution to conflict? And how can we all witness to peace in a very troubled world? Those key questions were at the heart of a seminar on Wednesday organised by the St. Egidio Lay Catholic Community here in Rome. Speakers at the seminar, entitled Religions and Violence, came from all the main faith traditions, examining the causes of violence and suggesting ways of working for reconciliation and peace across different ethnic, religious and national divisions. Among those offering practical solutions to combat the current increase in religious violence was Jerry White, who works with the US State Department's Bureau of Conflict and Stabilization Operations. A survivor of a landmine explosion and a veteran of several history-making campaigns, White told me why he believes religion must be part of the solution to conflicts around the world today.
I think we're seeing sort of the religification of violence or the politicization of religion. But really, for most of the planet, which is nearly 85% of the world, find meaning and peace in their resilience of religions. So I think we actually have to look at religion and religious communities as an antidote and a source of peace and nonviolence, and then actually have a collective stand against those who would hijack religions in the name of violence and do things that are actually like counterproductive for the world and perhaps the silent majority.
That's what your bureau is trying to do, isn't it? You're talking about learning lessons from the past decade. What do you see as the most significant of these lessons that we can perhaps draw ideas from?
I think when in the past we have made religion and violence sort of synonymous or confusing, it has been counterproductive, or just framed it in terms of countering violent extremism post 9/11. So one of the things we're trying to do is expand that conversation to engage with religious or faith-based communities around the world. So Secretary Kerry has recently launched, in the summer of 2013, a new office for that effect, to really engage with faith-based community initiatives dealing with things of justice and peace and the environment and many of the issues that are facing us collectively that we need to work together on.
This is a very interesting initiative, given that the number one rule in America is separation of church and state.
Yeah, the Establishment Clause of our Constitution, is pretty clear about that wall between church and state. But it turns out we fund and work very productively with faith-based communities throughout Africa, with HIV/AIDS, with development. So, in fact, the White House and the Secretary of State have created sort of three strands of effort. One, to deal with religious communities in a channeling development and economic support. The other is for the advancement of religious freedom and human rights. And lastly, the use of faith-based communities in conflict mitigation and crisis response. These are three fundamental areas where faith-based communities are on the front lines doing the work, and so we need to acknowledge that ongoing partnership.
It's also an area where you have particular experience, don't you? Can you share some of your own examples of where you've really seen this working?
I think even in Bosnia, when I first worked there with landmine victims back in the 1990s, it was clear that the country was suffering from the trauma of war and ethno-religious war, where communities and neighbors had turned on each other. So you had to figure out what are the natural resiliencies, which include religion and belief. So how do you tap into a survivor's own intrinsic resilience, their own belief patterns, their social support networks? And unless you are tapping into civil society, which also includes mosques and churches and synagogues, etc., I think some of us think of civil society as some secular entity, but in fact, mosques and faith-based leaders and civic organizations are all part of civil society and rebuild communities after war.
Another lesson that you're talking about drawing from the experience of the anti-landmine campaign is this idea of really working in partnership, isn't it?
Yeah, I think one of the things you look at with strategies to make a difference, if we want to stop violence and killing in the name of God, no one can go it alone. You have to look at coalition building, changing in policies and narrative, as well as working with communities. I mean, violence like politics is local. That's where it manifests itself. So I think you have to look at campaigns such as the International Campaign to Ban Landmines, such as the International Disability Caucus that created the Convention on the Rights of People with Disabilities. How do we celebrate difference in the world? Just like we're all differently abled, we're differently faithed, as it turns out, and behave and practice our faiths differently. How do we respect that, as part of the Human Rights Declaration, that all people are created equal in dignity and rights? We're all different, and that deserves fundamental respect.
It's also vitally important, the use of language around violence, isn't it? We've been hearing here about the true meaning of jihad, not at all what most people in the world would understand as a holy war.
Yeah, I think the point was made by some of the colleagues, but also President Obama and others, to not couple these words like Islamic terrorist or extremist, decouple them. In fact, delete that word. A terrorist is a terrorist, a criminal is a criminal. But to actually create associations with adjectives or affiliations creates the wrong impression. So language does matter. It's very powerful. And there shouldn't be a hierarchy of like who's a worse terrorist or a better terrorist depending on what type of religious affiliation or ideological affiliation they have. Violence in the name of God, period, should be exposed, and we should stand collectively against it.
It's very difficult to try and put this idea across in the age of internet, when ideas gain so much traction there instantly, overnight. People buy into what are very often very mistaken concepts.
I think one of the challenges, too, is people in this day and age, although that we communicate more, sometimes there's a passivity or feeling that it's useless or futile. So violence has been with us forever, or fighting in the Middle East will never go away. It's as old as Cain and Abel, etc. And even in the landmine campaign, we realized that our work begins at no. At first, people said, you'll never ban landmines. These are cheap force multipliers, and the Pentagon and NATO and all the fighting powers, including non-state actors, like them. So good luck with that. It turns out that I think in good advocacy, where you're transforming for the good of the planet, hard work and the right cause wins with collective action. So working with coalitions and partners and people-to-people communities fundamentally matters to change that mindset that says we can't do it. I absolutely believe that we could start create a movement to stop killing in the name of God and work together on that. And I think with the rise of religiously infused violence in all the headlines, but even statistically with each year we're seeing a growth in this type of violence, we must take a collective stand and take action. It's not responsible to look the other way and shrug.
Talking about the Middle East, you said that you believe Pope Francis's visit could be a vital catalyst towards a peaceful solution, a settlement in that region. Why do you say that?
Well, I happen to believe, perhaps working in social change around the world, that transformation requires icons as well. And the Holy Land is filled with icons, Jerusalem, the Jordan River. And now Pope Francis, St. Francis is an icon of peace building. So with His Holiness Pope Francis' agenda of poverty and sort of peace and the environment, it all comes together on this trip. And also the United States is doing its job in setting the table, negotiating tireless efforts on behalf of Secretary Kerry and the White House to pull the parties together, negotiate final status solutions. That's not what someone like Pope Francis would go do, but his affirmation of the need for a two-state solution, his affirmation of ongoing efforts to create peace dividends and sort of and aspire higher for the fate of Jerusalem, because 4 billion people around the world, 4 billion descendants of Abraham, the monotheisms, care about Jerusalem, care about peace in the Middle East, you know, wish they could make a pilgrimage one day. So we want to create this messaging of peace. And he, as Pope, as, you know, the father, the patriarch of over 1 billion people, carries that message not just from Rome, but from Latin America and Buenos Aires and Indonesia and all around where there are Catholics and Christians who are part of the third side, who care a lot about peace in the Middle East. So I think reactivating the Christian voice is absolutely critical, and Pope Francis' visit in May of this year is a very important catalyst for that message.
My thanks there to Jerry White of the U.S. State Department's Bureau of Conflict and Stabilization Operations.